Yeah, so this is the title, and this talk will be a review of many people's work, and it's supposed to be a non-technical presentation, so if you have questions, please ask. Now, explaining the title, so it's there are two parts here, radioactivity and heavy iron physics. So first, let me say, what is heavy iron physics? And by heavy iron physics, I have in mind basically heavy iron collisions, which is an experimental program to study QCD at high energy density, not high energy, but at high energy density. And the current active experimental facility is RIC, which stands for Relativistic Heavy Iron Collider in Brookhaven, New York. So this is the space view of the accelerator. So this is about 1 kilometer in diameter. It started in year 2000, collides gold nuclei at center of mass energy, about 200 GeV per nucleon. And the quest of this program is to find and study quark-gluon plasma, which is roughly the confined state of QCD, and the relevant mathematical tool is quantum field theory at finite temperature and density. And so one thing to notice is that it is not obvious a priori that a thermal state will be produced in this collision, but there is some evidence, experimental evidence for thermalization, which is the result of work of many people and analysis of lots of data and non-trivial calculations.
One question, what are the reasons that one wouldn't expect the thermal state to form here? Simple statements as
well? Well, if it flies out before it thermalizes, then...
Okay, yeah, in some cases, I guess, but you know, certainly if you actually have two large things with many degrees of freedom interacting at high energy,
Yes, but it's a question of real numbers, right? And these real numbers have to be analyzed with some, you know, real models. So.
They have to stay together.
Yeah, right.
Which they don't.
Whether it sticks.
And so what I want to say is that there are several, you know, several evidences.
So then, is the evidence that's puzzling, right?
I don't know. It's whatever you want to think. It's particle abundances and ratios, which are reproduced by statistical models. Second is elliptic flow, which is the hydrodynamic expansion, which is reproduced by hydrodynamic models, and there's jet quenching, which is again reproduced by various models and indicate short mean free pass in the thermal medium. So I'm no expert, of course, on this, you know, models, but I mean
jet quenching, fewer jets than
yes. I will explain this later. So there is a big review which is called Quantin Hunting Quark-gluon Plasma, which is published by RIC. And if you want, you know, to learn about this, there is quite extensive, you know, explanation and references in here. So optimistically, you said that quark-gluon plasma is hidden somewhere, you know, in this collision. Now, the second part of the title is ADS-CFT, and of course, I don't have to explain to this audience what ADS-CFT is, but just for the sake of completeness, I will say
you
that...
You discuss some of the experimental items because I thought
yes.
What they're finding is not the quark-gluon, or a weakly interacting.
Yes. I will show some of the experimental graphs. ADS-CFT is basically a statement of duality between a gauge theory and string theory. It was the simplest version is equivalence between four-dimensional maximally supersymmetric Young-Mills theory and type 2B strings on this background space-time, where the parameters of the field theory are matched to the parameters of string theory. In the following way, the Toft coupling is matched to radius of curvature squared of the background space divided by alpha prime, and the number of colors is related to string coupling. And there are some standard formulas which you have seen probably many times about the equality of partition functions in two theories. And basically the how to compute two-point function by just evaluating classical action on the equation of motion. Now, what I want to emphasize here is that you can think about ADS-CFT in kind of two ways. One way to think about it is that, you know, an exact nice duality, which, you know, is good for string theory. But another way to think about ADS-CFT is just basically a tool to define, either to define a quantum field theory or perform computations in field theory. And I will take this attitude in this talk, that it is basically a tool to, you know, perform computations in strongly coupled quantum field theory. And even though it says here n equal 4 super young Mills, it of course applies to field theories beyond n equal 4. Now, what do these things have to do with each other? Well, one can ask a modest question, that is, can a DSFT be useful to understand finite temperature QCD? And one can ask a bold question, can a DSFT be useful to understand the actual dynamics of the collision? And I will take a modest attitude in this talk, and even though I briefly mentioned some of the, you know, bold speculations. And some comments here is that, of course, n equal 4 is the simplest examples. Theories which are much more similar to QCD can be analyzed by DSFT methods. Applications of DSFT to thermal QCD is not yet exhausted. There is more work to be done, and it's reasonable to ask how far one can push this program. And I think it's not a waste of time to perform these calculations in DSFT, because results are so easy to obtain compared to the conventional methods in gauge theory, in strongly coupled gauge theory. And for the skeptics, potential skeptics here, if there were an effective tool to do real-time computations in strongly coupled QCD at finite temperature and chemical potential, there would be no need to invoke a DSFT. But in the absence of such a tool, a DSFT is the best we have for some questions. And independent of Rieke, understanding finite temperature field theory is an interesting question by itself, and a DSFT can be useful in searching for universal properties. This shear viscosity is one example which I mentioned later. Now let me briefly say why n equal 4 super young Mills may have something to do with thermal QCD, why it is not crazy to think that, you know, this conformal series may be relevant. So one question you may ask is that n equal 4 is supersymmetric, but QCD is not. And the answer to that is that we're interested in finite temperature, and supersymmetry is not expected to play any significant role there. And another question is that n equal 4 is conformal, but QCD is asymptotically free. And the answer to that is, well, let's look at thermodynamics of QCD and see if it is consistent, if it manifests any conformal symmetry. So this picture shows here results of lattice simulations for energy density of QCD with various flavor content divided by T to the 4. And these arrows here indicate the energy density in free theory, the Stefan-Boltzmann result. So you see they're pretty much, you know, horizontal here and do not depend on much on temperature. Now you can make another graph, which is take, you know, these data and divide them by the free results. So plot not just E over T to the 4, but E over E Stefan-Boltzmann. And you get, you know, this curves which are very close to each other. And again, pretty much horizontal. Now you may ask, well, what if you plot the result of n equal 4 super young Mills here? Where is it? Well, and it's here, where this number is the famous 3/4, which relates the entropy or whatever free energy in strongly coupled super young Mills to the one in free theory.
So you're saying that even in theories of 3, you're closer to the strongly coupled theory than to the free one. These things are not heading towards one very fast. Is that what you mean?
Yes, they're not heading towards one. They're heading very slowly, yeah. Very slowly. And so it's still very strongly coupled, but it is, you know, 3/4 of the free result. And of course, you must say it's you know, it's a coincidence that, you know, n equal 4 curve is very close here, which it probably is. But what I wanted to emphasize is that the fact that they are horizontal means that conformal symmetry of n equal 4 is totally okay with this QCD.
So in the Rieke experiments, what is the estimate of T over TC?
Well, TC is estimate about 170 MeV, and Rieke experiments is around this number, slightly above this number. It's maybe 200. It's very close. Yes. So in this region, you know, it's 170 MeV. QCD perturbation theory is not to be trusted for temperatures of order, you know, with TC or 2TC, 3TC. And when you want to perform real-time computations, then Lattice is, you know, it's very difficult to use because Lattice does Euclidean for you. And so the idea is to use strongly coupled N equal 4 superamp mills as a model for QCD in this temperature range from about 2 dC to, you know, 4, 5, 6
dC. What did you say the center of mass energy was per
liquid? 200 GeV.
GeV, okay. So the temperature is a lot lower.
Yes.
Not a lot.
The temperature is a factor of 1,000 lower than the energy per nuclear. Okay. Like, mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well, except you're saying you're. Oh, well, yeah, the energy per nuclear doesn't determine the temperature of the gas.
Well,
in fact, the temperature of the gas is about
200.
Yeah, that's very close.
Yeah, it's close to DC, but way below the end.
But that's not the relevant quantity there. And the other question is, if you compare, lattice to N equals 4 type thing, you compare N equals 4 to N equals 1, how does that change? I mean, has this been known for N equals?
Oh, I don't know.
Does that change a lot?
There's no universal.
Well, N equal 1 is asymptotically free.
Right?
N equal 1 is asymptotically free.
Okay,
I'm talking about the
Kleinian
model.
Oh, that's. I don't know.
I mean, you'd like not only this to be a good, not so far from what is from the lattice calculation, but also not so far from more realistic ADS-CP theory.
There are the Clifford theory. There are the N equals 2 theories, mm-hmm. that are the formulas for pre-closed N equals 4. But mm-hmm. is it anyone who has the 3/4 there? I mean, there should be some.
The only papers that I'm familiar with is there were these two papers by Igor and Kuznetsov from there's a black hole solution that asks you to the Kuznetsov circuit solution. That's the one thing.
First, all the things that are reliable as much matter as for, it's just a little less symmetric.
So this talk I will plan to discuss applications of ADS-CFT to several points. One is momentum transport, electromagnetic response, energy loss by heavy quark, and thermalization briefly. And then I will conclude with some open problems. Momentum transport. Basically a question of how momentum relaxes is governed by conservation law for energy momentum tensor, where epsilon here is energy density, pi is momentum density, plus constitutive relations which relate stress, which appears here in the right hand side, to the conserved densities which appear in the left hand side. And one performs this, you know, sort of derivative expansion for gradients of pi, and the coefficient of the traceless part is called shear viscosity over enthalpy. Coefficient of the trace part is called, this one is called bulk viscosity. V squared is the speed of sound. And these coefficients are, so think about this as some sort of effective field theory description for long wavelengths, fluctuations above thermal equilibrium. And these coefficients are input from microscopic physics. And the eigenmodes of this system, of this plus this, of this system of equations, are the shear mode, which says that transverse momentum density relaxes diffusively, and the sound mode, where the, both longitudinal momentum and energy density oscillate. So the long wavelength response is controlled by small number of kinetic coefficients. know how to relate them to the actual microscopic physics is to remember about hydrodynamic singularities, is that these hydrodynamic modes that which I talked before about before manifest themselves as hydrodynamic singularities at small frequency and momentum. For example, this two-point function of transverse momentum has this kind of shear mode diffusive pole singularity, and by playing with this and other expressions for correlation functions, one can derive so-called Cooper formulas, which relate kinetic which relate shear and bulk viscosities to spectral functions of various components of energy momentum tensor at 0-3 momentum and in the limit of small frequency. Now, well, this is actually where IDSFT can come in handy, because viscosities are extracted from real-time correlation functions, and real-time correlation functions are very hard to compute on the lattice, but very easy to compute in IDSFT. So let's go ahead and compute those spectral functions here in n equals 4 super young mills. And if you do this, here is the result. So what you're looking at are the plots of the spectral function, which is Fourier transform of the commutator, which is equivalently imaginary part of the retarded Green's function. So this graph here shows the spectral function for transverse stress, xy, with zero temperature contribution subtracted as a function of dimensionless frequency. And shear viscosity is, and different curves here correspond to different values of 3 momentum. And this one here corresponds to k equals 0, and shear viscosity is read off from, you know, the slope here, which is equal to 1/2, and which gives rise to, you know, shear viscosity equal to this value. In this expression, t cubed is of course fixed by conformal invariance, because n equal 4 is conformal, and n squared is fixed by the number of degrees of freedom. And but it's, I mean, a non-trivial statement is probably that it has a finite limit at large Hoft coupling. Even though this expression is, you know, not very surprising, so n squared t cubed, you can understand it is still satisfying that you can compute shear viscosity from first principles. Now, you can also look at other spectral functions, which is the transverse momentum and energy density. And again, these curves are for different values of 3 momentum. And the satisfying feature which you see here is the presence of these peaks, the hydrodynamic peaks, which correspond to these hydrodynamic modes, which I mentioned before. So this peak is the shear mode peak, which corresponds to the transverse momentum density, this one, the diffusive one, and the next one is this sound mode peak. And these peaks become sharper as three momentum decreases, which is again perfectly consistent with what you expect from classical hydrodynamics. So hydrodynamic peaks are clearly visible in dual classical gravity, which is again a very satisfying feature of what you find from IDSFT. Now, you may ask, where do these oscillations come from? And they come, you can understand them if you remember that the spectral function is imaginary part of the retarded function. And if you look at the analytic structure of the retarded function, and what you find is that retarded Green's functions have infinite series of poles in the lower half plane of complex frequency. So this shows poles of the transverse stress. These are the singularities of the transverse momentum. These are singularities of energy density. Now, all these poles look pretty much the same, except for these ones, which are marked with large dots. So these poles are distinguished in that as you decrease 3 momentum, these poles approach the real axis. And these poles are, again, exactly the same hydrodynamic singularities that I mentioned before. And this condition that omega goes to 0 as k goes to 0 is, again, the defining condition of a hydrodynamic mode. And I guess I didn't mention that, but you can show that singularities of the retarded Green's functions are quasi-normal modes of the dual gravitational background. Now, so this was about shear viscosity in n equal 4 super young mills. Now, can you actually compute shear viscosity in real QCD by, you know, doing some lattice simulation. And for a bit, let's look at the spectral functions again. So real-time spectral functions are very different at strong and weak coupling. So what this picture shows is it shows again this spectral functions for transverse stress, which is relevant for shear viscosity for different theories. So this red curve here is the spectral function in strongly coupled super young Mills theory. So this picture was only finite temperature contribution to it. Now this red curve is the full spectral function. Now the dashed one, which you can barely see here because it has a delta function singularity here and then continues here, is a spectral function in free super young Mills theory, which gives rise to infinite viscosity. And purple is the spectral function in weakly coupled super young Mills theory, which gives rise to very large viscosity with this delta function, you know, smeared. And the blue curve is the zero temperatures. Now, the value of viscosity is set by the intercept of the spectral function with this vertical axis. So strongly coupled super young Mills has some small viscosity. Weakly coupled has very large viscosity. And, you know, free theory has infinite viscosity. Now, you can ask, now, all this, you know, the spectral functions, real-time spectral functions are different. Now, how do Euclidean spectral functions look like? And it turns out that Euclidean correlators are almost the same. Now, so you take this relation between Euclidean function as a function of imaginary time, how it is related to spectral function, and you know, tau is this imaginary time, beta is inverse temperature. You take these functions, you integrate them with this weight, so this is what you find. So the red curve is infinite coupling, the dashed curve is free theory. And you see that Euclidean correlators are basically more or less the same, with the biggest difference here is about 10%. So a theory which has infinite viscosity and a theory which has very small viscosity have Euclidean correlators which differ by at most 10%.
What correlator is this again? Sorry.
This is for transverse stress. In the dual theory, it's basically the same. You solve the wave equation for the minimally coupled massless scalar. Now you look at the lattice simulations that, you know, what those people do who try to extract shear viscosity from the lattice, and then you find that, you know, Euclidean correlators, which they compute, has huge errors, it's several hundred percent, and then you see that, you know, since, you know, these two infinite coupling, and, you know, so infinite viscosity and small viscosity differ by this small amount.
Even less than 3/4. I mean, at the entropy's never by.
Well, the entropy differs by a very small amount, but shear viscosity here differs by a huge amount. But still, the Euclidean correlators differ by a very small amount. And since simulations have very huge error bars, there is no chance that, you know, you can see lattice can determine shear viscosity for you.
Why is that?
I don't know. Well, the correlators, they can do much better with correlators that which correlate fermionic observables with current, but if you have to correlate gluons, they say it's very noisy. So they can do much better with the diffusion coefficient, but with shear viscosity. Now, continuing about shear viscosity, the lower bound. Now this picture here is a page from American Journal of Physics, which is a lecture given by, it's called Life at Low Reynolds Number Lecture given by Ed Purcell in honor of Victor Weisskopf. So there is a paragraph here which you cannot probably read, so I blowed it up here. So it says, if you look at the chemical rubber handbook table, you'll find that there is almost no liquid with viscosity much lower than that of water. The viscosities have a big range, but they stop at the same place. So this was 1977. Well, it's interesting. So this was Ed Purcell. Now, if you look at n equal 4, then you say, well, this ratio, which is the relevant ratio which controls the damping rate of hydrodynamic modes, so it's not just viscosity, but viscosity of our entropy density, which controls the damping rate. It's a large number at small coupling. It's equal to 1 over 4 pi at large coupling. And it's natural to assume that in superionic Mills, it's always greater than 4 pi. Now, then you may ask, is this ratio universal? So this was just a speculation. Of course, we know that this ratio, the equality, is universal. It has been proven for a large class of theories with gravity duals, but it has not been proven or analyzed from
it's
the...
Proven,
no, it's been proven in the sense, if you believe in Eddie's CFT, it's been proven that if you take a general background space-time which corresponds to some unknown dual field theory and calculate shear viscosity for that theory, this ratio is given by this number.
I mean, it just follows from the definition of...
This universality follows from the universality of basically absorption cross-section by the black holes, which you can prove, because this two-point Green's function can be related in it by ADS-CFT to the absorption cross-section, which is, proportional to the area, and this you can prove from, linearized gravity, and so this happens to be proportional to the area, and this happens to be proportional to the area, so they cancel and cube.
So one-fourth is just like...
But there has been, no understanding of this from
so
purely field theory.
A large class of, but not all, field theory with gravity duals. So what's a theory with a gravity dual for which this doesn't apply?
What? Well, for example, this theorem that I referred to, that the cross section is proportional to the area of the horizon. Well, the paper that I saw didn't analyze rotating black holes, for example, which corresponds to finite chemical potential. So for finite chemical potential, the ratio was calculated, I think, by Andre and Son recently, and they again found that it is 1/4 pi, but I don't think there is a proof for completely general backgrounds. For some class of backgrounds,
but for static ones at least.
Yes.
This would apply.
Yes.
So what's the value again for water? This lower value in this CRT.
For water, I didn't say what it was, but it depends on pressure, of course, and temperature and.
They're talking about some lower bound range values. What is it?
Oh goodness! It's way bigger. Well, for gases it's way bigger. For liquids it's in the hundreds,
okay.
And for some it's in the tens. Now, okay. So what is the viscosity actually measured at Rieck? You may ask. Well, and of course Rieck does not measure viscosity. I mean, if we had, a jar of quark gluon plasma, then we can, put a, torsional pendulum and measure viscosity there. But, Rieck doesn't do this. Rather, measured angular distribution of particles produced on the collision are confronted with hydrodynamic models of the fireball expansion. And quantitatively, this is characterized by zimuthal anisotropy of particle distribution. So if you have two particles which collide like that, if you look along the axis of the collision, then this is what you see for the overlap region here. Right, and so you see that the reaction region has this kind of lentil shape, which will, the expansion of this region will give rise to anisotropy in distribution of particles, and this is the polar angle here, the phi. So this is quantified by the second Fourier coefficient, which people call the elliptic flow.
So what did you draw on the blackboard here? The circles are
what? So the circles are nuclei. Nuclei. They collide moving along the axis that goes into the blackboard. So one goes this way, other goes this way, and this is the overlap region for them. Yes. And this is the polar angle.
So in comparing with these viscosities, for example, that you get from the black hole calculations, is that suggesting that region is somehow, from the ABS point of view, is a strongly coupled gravity region? That's where it's kind of...
Well, what this region is, nobody knows. It's, it's... But if you assume that at some point, quark gluon plasma is formed in this region, then you have to, take some suitable initial conditions, the mean free pass, the equation of state, the transition parameters to the hadronic phase, and, do a perform a complicated simulation with your hadrodynamic, you know, equations and compute something for this coefficient. And viscosity there is just one of the parameters that you use to, you know, to fit the data. So this picture, which is taken from this paper, shows combined measurements of Phoenix and Star for the elliptic flow. So these dots here are different species of particles. And our yellow band here, these are hydrodynamic calculations for various, you know, fitting parameters. And it turns out that to reproduce elliptic flow from hydrodynamics, the value of eta over s must be a small number. It should be about within a factor of 4 of the conjectured bound.
So you mean to reproduce the data or to use this expansion?
No, to reproduce the this curves.
So how does that determine
eta over s? Well, no, this does not determine eta over s. So you use different values of eta over s and see how this curve will look like.
Eta over s determines V2
or P? It will affect the shape of this curve. It will, you know, make it either this way or this way. Yes, yes. If you larger viscosities or larger values of eta over s, move it in this direction.
So there's some kind of linear dependence?
I don't ask me about these dependencies because, I mean, there are, I don't know.
This is like a hard calculation. It's
a simulation. It's not back of the envelope estimate. It's a simulation with several fitting parameters, where viscosity is just one of them.
So, but it depends on a lot. What else does it depend on?
What you take for your initial state, the equation of state, the latent heat of the transition.
If you have to put a lot of input. But so when you say must be small.
Mm-hmm.
That means that people tried and
yes.
very hard to get it to agree with what you would expect from perturbation theory and failed.
No. What people try to do first is they try to ideal hydrodynamics. That's right. Say viscosity, I mean, let's forget about viscosity at all and perform simulations with ideal hydrodynamics. And they find a fairly good agreement. Now they say, let's now put in the viscosity which you compute from perturbation theory, and they find a poor agreement. Now they say, okay, let's put in some, you know, small value of viscosity which we don't know where it comes from, and then I mean, you find a good agreement. So, and another thing is that, I asked people who perform these simulations, and they tell me that small but finite value of this ratio is better than zero value.
Better than zero.
So.
And the perturbative value, so the eight over s. Is 1/12 or so, which is bound. Whereas the perturbative values are what?
Well, it depends what you take for the coupling, because it's 1 over g to the 4. And
in the range of? So you say that perturbatively it's 1 over g to the 4?
Yes, but then there is some large numerical coefficient in it too, which is some happens to come out from some, I don't know, some large number. So it's I don't remember.
I'm sorry, what is the viscosity cloud in a weakly coupled perturbative calculation? I might have
it too.
Yeah.
Well the idea is that a viscosity
Zero viscosity. Free particles
aren't free particles aren't a fluid. Well, free particles aren't a fluid, and free particles don't thermalize. So to understand this dependence on viscosity. So imagine a flow of gas or a flow of fluid, where there is a velocity gradient in this direction. Now, viscosity tells you about the internal friction between these layers of fluid. Mm-hmm. And in simple kinetic theory estimation, it's proportional to the mean free path of the collision. Now, if you see that if mean free path is large, which means viscosity is large, large mean free path corresponds to larger momentum transfer between these layers. So.
Is it because if particles don't scatter much, it'll scatter off one of the moving edges, and then without scattering, get to the other and convey the information of the large velocity gradient?
Yeah.
But the gradients reach further.
No. If you imagine like tuning the coupling, if you imagine lowering the coupling, then it's not just your viscosity grows, but your domain of the applicability of the hydrodynamic, changes because you have to look at larger and larger waves.
Is this slight tangent about which parameters we're talking about, the shear viscosity, is this the same viscosity that governs molasses pouring out of the bottle and makes it go slowly, or is it a different parameter?
Well, it's the same parameter, but when molasses goes out of the bottle, it is not described by those simple equations which I wrote down on the
first slide. There in Sutherland, where it has to be very strong, and it seems very viscous.
Right.
It's strange that it's
I have this really something. My intuition isn't matching the definition.
No, it's not. No, this is right. Exactly. It's one of these things that's very counterintuitive. I don't know.
Another way of understanding data, if one asks, suppose I were to violate the bound completely, then we will not fit the data at all?
It will fit, but it...
So everything is really, there's a lot of freedom.
Well, there is some freedom, but there is not a lot of freedom. I mean, for example, if you make this very large, I mean, if you make it a factor of 10 of the bound, it will not, But, I mean, as I said, this ratio is just one of the parameters.
So data doesn't really prove this.
Well...
No, but what's surprising, what you're saying, the data indicates that the viscosity has to be an order of magnitude smaller than what you...
Yes.
Which is surprising. It's evidence that we don't have a simple weakly interacting
force. Do the turbulent have different divergences?
Yes, they do.
Control?
Well, you can use kinetic theory, which is just a class of classical Boltzmann equation.
No, I think what you mean that if you have that's
about an
expansion
of
Bernstein's
order
at some point.
Where are you? I'm sorry, a bunch of soft blue order. Strong effects, no matter how we
combine those. Could you avoid this conclusion that eta over s has to be small if you didn't assume that this thing was in equilibrium calculation?
So what I said here, it's optimistically. I mean, there is still. I mean, this is, I think, what most people believe, but. Because the elliptic flow is so well reproduced, but it assumes short thermalization time,
but also this the short time for mechanical equilibration of stresses, right?
Yes.
Which is possibly different than thermal equilibration time.
Yes, so I mean, for example, you say, can you have viscosity large, but can you have large viscosity, but some screwed up equation of state which would compensate for that, right? Some screwed up latent heat in the transition, and probably you could. But again, I'm not an expert, but it's
this. For other measurements too.
Well, to test hydrodynamics. This is the best. Okay. Now moving on. Electromagnetic response. Well, this is the question. How brightly does a plasma glow? Well, I can answer this quantitatively. So gamma is the number of photons per unit time, per unit volume, produced in the plasma, photon interaction controlled by this small coupling, are, take this coupling to be very small and say that the photons do not thermalize, they're just free streaming photons, then the this d gamma over dk is given by simply the two-point function of the electromagnetic current, which is, again, the retarded Green's function. So photon spectrum is current-current spectral function, which is, again, you can think about it as some sort of gray body factor. And this expression is true to leading order in E, which is this small coupling, but to all orders in G. And to evaluate this perturbatively, it's not an easy. I mean, many people did this. You can, for example, look at this paper. Now,
people copy the low orders in G?
Yes.
We know a lot about that correlation function experimental. What region of K do you need?
Well, in ADS-CFT, you can calculate for all K.
Forget about geometry.
No. Wait. In.
Why can't you just take E plus and G minus N? This is measured.
Not in a thermal state. Not in thermal QCD.
Sorry.
This has not been measured in thermal QCD, right?
It's a finite temperature, and no plus E minus is
that's for sure. So this is a.
Yes. So this is evaluated in thermal equilibrium.
Thermal propagators for the quarks, right?
Yes. Well, and you may ask, how brightly does N equal 4 plasma glow? Well, and then you ask, well, what do you mean? N equal 4 doesn't have a photon, which means it doesn't have a U1 gauge field coupled to a conserved current.
So, Lindsay, this has been calculated in some order. Why is it not easy?
Well, it is not easy because if you want to include all contributions, then you have to include multiple soft scattering, which is so-called Landau-Migdal-Pomeranchuk effect, and you have to resum ladder diagram. I mean, it's not that, you know, it's impossible, but it's, you know, it's only in, you know, 2001 that Peter, Guy, and Larry, you know, did the full, you know, leading order computation of this. It's not that it's, you know, terribly hard, but I mean you have to do some work.
It's harder than ADS-CFT.
It's for sure harder than ADS-CFT. And so ADS-CFT, so N equal 4 doesn't have a photon. Well, it doesn't have a photon, let's introduce one. And to do so, let's gauge U1 subgroup SU4 R symmetry group with some small coupling E. Now R symmetry is anomalous, of course, but let's add some spectators to cancel this anomaly. And take E to be small again so that these photons don't thermalize. Now this current, which is with some spectator said it is conserved non-anomalous coupled to U1 gauge field. And again to lowest order in E, this current is current for R symmetry plus some spectator loop, which does not contribute because one photon is kinematically forbidden. And so what you say is photon emission rate is given by R current spectral function. So just take, you know, the simple results for R currents and reinterpret them as photon production. And here is a photon emission spectrum of super-young Mills plus electromagnetism. So the thick line here is the pure, you know, Boltzmann factor. The thin line here is the modified N equal 4 result. And a small x is, you know, goes to constant, large x, it decays logarithmically. And again, it's some finite, you know, lambda-independent trait at strong coupling. Now, you ask, what about experiment? And this is the experiment. This is Phoenix data from photon production taken from this paper. What this shows is basically the number of photons produced for various centralities of the collision. So this is the most central, this is the most peripheral. So the dots here are the data. The lines
here. Spotting now versus PT.
Versus PT. The points here are the data. The lines here are the theoretical curves which you obtain by just taking photon production in PP collisions times the number of participating nucleons. And so what you see is that this photon production from gold, gold is very well described by basically taking photon production from pp times the number of, you know, participating nucleons. And which means that most photons come from initial state interaction, but not from the quark-gluon plasma, if it is formed there. But though there is still some, you know, deviation here, and there is still some room for thermal QGP photons. But
it's not clear that you just add it to that. That will count.
So what?
It's not obvious that they're at, those effects are additive.
Wait. Well, I mean, this is what these bands represent for, because you don't know the exact number of constituents, and so this is the uncertainty, the number of the colliding. And so see that because there is kind of relatively good, well, very good agreement with data here, there is not much room left for thermal QGP photons, but there is still some room, and there are more precise experiments which are planned to look for thermal QGP photons.
How does that ADS-CFT differ from the perturbative?
Well, I haven't figured this out yet, because see, the perturbative result was not computed for n equal 4. You cannot take free n equal 4 and.
No, but you could normalize it to the charge. You know there's some of the charge. Presumably, you just normalize.
Well, yes, but the perturbative results were done with fermions, and now n equal 4 has scalars, which you also have.
Yeah, right. Well, you have no choice.
So you have to. Well, I just haven't done this yet, but it's possible to do so, and yeah, I just haven't done this yet. Now, next energy loss.
So if you go back, the ADS-CFT result, if you normalize it somehow by dividing by sigma q squared, give you some what order of magnitude compared to this? You don't know because of normalization.
I don't know, but it's good. Yeah, I don't know.
Since it's only one loop, it should just be pushing the sum of q squared.
Yes.
So you couldn't do this. Normalize it by multiplying by the sum of q squared for the quarks and divide by the sum of all the q over squared for the cluster.
Well, I don't know if scalars contribute the same because in equal for scalars also.
You know, it's still proportional to their charges.
You're
going to have to do something like that.
Yes, for sure. Andre sent me this graph, I don't know, a couple of days ago. I just haven't done this yet. Well, and it's again, what you said is completely doable, and I mean, one can do this. That there is nothing prohibited. But energy loss by a heavy probe. So problem, have in mind is to have a probe.
You gave evidence. Things that haven't measured on top of it, like jet suppression.
Mm-hmm.
So there, that depends on knowing the mean free path. Is that something?
Well, my understanding was that jet suppression for light quarks are well described by gluon Bremsstrahlung. And perturbative QCD is not.
The question, if you find one area, perturbative QCD doesn't work very well at all, like the viscosity, wouldn't you expect that it would not work very well? I mean, so what? Can you use ADS-CFT not to explain those successes as well?
We haven't tried, but it's okay. So let me say this: there are surprisingly few people who try to, you know, to push this program, and I was currently occupied with, you know, heavy probe and, you know, photons, and, you know, but I mean, if somebody Sure. Okay, so any probe moving through a thermal medium. So think about charm quark. It's 1.3 moving through a plasma of 200. So you model this in the ADS-CFT by n equal 4 super increments plus fundamental matter with small number of flavors suggested by Karchen cuts. The dual geometry, think about putting D7 brains in the background, where the position of these brains sets the mass of the quark. So a static quark is modeled by a string, which is stretched between the brain and the horizon. You can evaluate this energy at zero temperature, identify this as some bare mass, evaluate this at finite temperature, find this U minus UH, so this is thermal mass. And when the quark is heavy, the string is classical. And to analyze energy loss, you solve classical equations of motion for a full string. That's simple. And for a heavy, infinitely heavy quark, you can do this analytically. So send this UM to infinity. And then imagine that you move this heavy quark by hand at a finite speed. Then you say, well, the string moving at finite some non-zero speed should be a good solution. Well, this string profile indeed solves equations of motion. However, it's minus g, the determinant of the induced metric, it flips sign at some non-zero value here and there, in the bulk. When energy and momentum become complex, so we say the solution is unphysical. Discard this. Now, one can still find stationary solution, which is some fixed profile, x of u plus vt moving at some constant speed. So one can find such x of u that minus g is positive everywhere.
So that g is indeed the induced
metric. It's positive everywhere. Now, what is the interpretation of this? Now, you know that if you move something through a thermal medium, you should lose energy. Now, here we force it to move at constant speed. So this means that we somehow pump some momentum in here. So we pump it in here, it leaks down the string and leaks over the other end in here. And so now to evaluate the energy loss, you just calculate how much momentum is leaking off at the other end. And so you do this and it's proportional to the momentum of this particle times some number, which you identify as the drag coefficient. And when mass is not infinite, you can solve these equations, basically the classical equations of motion which come from the Nambu-Goto action in this background. You can solve them numerically. So you find this thick curve. This is the infinite mass curve. And so what you find is that this expression is good for both relativistic and non-relativistic quarks. This drag coefficient here is independent of momentum. It does not have finite lambda goes to infinity limit. Now again, you can try to do some rough estimates, take this to be a charm quark temperature ratio of 7, alpha is 0.5, lambda equal 20.
Where is lambda 20 come from?
Well, lambda is g squared n, so if alpha is 0.5 and n equals 3. let's find this drag coefficient is roughly temperature. Now perturbative, you could perturbative drag coefficient, it's again in QCD, so it's like roughly 2 or 7. So, but it's like comparing apples and oranges. But in principle, it should be possible to do a more meaningful comparison, which we haven't done yet. If you believe this very rough estimates, then it says that this drag coefficient is larger at strong coupling.
The solution we have for the profile of the string, this cannot be understood in some way as the boost of the original static string.
I don't think so, no. Like,
because of the non-trivial
something to account for. It's hard.
Scale factor on the regular action.
Well, I don't know. This minus g, it really flips sign here. It goes through zero, goes from positive to negative. But this one is positive.
So if I take a straight string, the static one, and I boost it with a small velocity, why does the metric become flip sign? Is it just boosting a static string?
Well, from the field theory point of view, that boost invariance is gone at finite temperature because of the preferred frame.
So, yeah, that's right.
But here it's.
How can this be profit for man?
So what you're looking at is Phoenix data for electrons which come from heavy quark decay. Now what is plotted here is so-called RAA versus PT. Now what is this RAA? RAA is so-called nuclear modification factor, which tells you how much particles is produced in a collision compared to particles produced, how many particles is produced in a nuclear collision compared to how many particles is produced in a PP collision scaled by the number of collisions. So if it is one, this means you have as many particles as, you know, in PP scaled by the number of colliding centers. And if it is less than one, this means that there are fewer particles produced in nuclear collision. Now, this data is for non-photonic leptons, which comes from decay of heavy mesons. So, I mean, experimentalists, I mean, they're very smart. They can identify the electrons which come from, you know, D and B meson decays compared to, you know, from all other electrons. And they, you know, can compute this. And various models for how to compute this RIA utilize the diffusion coefficient for heavy quarks, which basically give rise to these heavy mesons for C and B quarks. And so these are some of the theoretical curves which are taken again from this paper. The lines are theoretical curves. No, the right curves which you should be looking at are these other two, the other twos. And these 1B and 1C are some curves with unphysical, you know, fitting parameters. Now, so again here you see that it's about by factor of 2 or 3, the theory, which is again based on gluon bremsstrahlung, it underestimates the energy loss for heavy quarks. But again, it does well for the same theory does well for light quarks, but underestimates it for heavy quarks. So you see, this theory doesn't work very well. But then there were some other papers by Derek Tini and Guy Moore, which, you know, said it's not gluon bremsstrahlung, it's 2-to-2 elastic scattering with the medium, and they say they can, you know, do this better.
It's what?
It's 2-to-2 elastic scattering. And they use Langevin equation to model that, to model that. But they said they can do, you know, better this, but it's still, you know, this area for heavy quarks and trick is a hot area now, and there will be a conference in Monterey this coming June, which maybe I'll go there and, you know, talk to people what the state of affairs is. How am I doing on time?
It's just past 2:30.
So. Oh, we started later.
Yeah.
So, well, thermalization. Well, I didn't intend to put up the slide on thermalization here. The only reason I put this up is that there were several papers recently that attempt to discuss this from a data safety perspective. Now, basic questions here are, is thermal equilibrium in a collision established? If it is it established on the partonic level at an early stage or on the hadronic level at a later stage? At what temperature and how does the state evolve? Now, these are, of course, I mean, very hard, you know, dynamical questions. And there are some papers which touch on these questions from ADS-CFT, by, you know, various authors, which include, you know, both solid results and speculations. Now, my take on this is skeptical, because in any attempt to understand thermalization in heavy ion collisions from ADS-CFT, one must be able to distinguish between hadron-hadron and gold-gold collisions. This is what this whole business of, you know, RAA is about. And one must be able to quantitatively understand the role of finite NC to, you know, to account for proper particle decay rates. And, you know, this question, these both two questions are very hard. So I would say that ADS-CFT is not currently very useful to understand the dynamical thermalization, even though it can be useful in understanding the, you know, equilibrium and near equilibrium properties.
Is it thought that QCD would, that single hadron collisions would thermalize in QCD?
Well, it depends. What, okay, so if you look at
any energy,
it depends what you mean by thermalized. So if you look at the hadron spectrum, right, then you find that this spectrum is roughly thermal. Well, this doesn't mean that it comes from a thermal source. This could mean that they just statistically fill, you know, the available phase space. Right, it's just like this example when, you know, pea is dropping down through you know, the snails and filling, you know, this Gaussian shaped curve. So the fact that, you know, this spectrum is thermal, it doesn't mean that it comes from a thermal
That's
source.
A good question. It's related. It's just not clear. I mean, I'm trying to visualize. You start with a small number of hadrons, and by the time you make enough to make a thermal state, they kind of move past each other, right? Is it?
Well, that's the hard question. Yeah, that's the hard question.
Yes, but at very large
ends. Strong
gravity is black hole. But at very large ends,
At very large end, you can argue by you know.
They argue it doesn't happen.
They'll argue that at large end it forms a stable, you know, state which they call a plasma ball.
For a long time. And has its origin in strong gravity. Sort of a horizon of the same kind of a thing.
But large ends are really different. Scattering two hadrons, scattering order n hadrons. I think that you really get into different.
Well, yeah, that's.
And it's small, and it's easily.
Okay, now coming to an end, the SFT has more to say. So this is a sample of random challenges for, you know, the SFT, both easy and hard. And again, I said there are not so many people who work on, you know, pushing this program on thermal SFT, but so if you're willing, you know, to think about some of these things. Well, first, the easiest is the deformations of n equal 4 to, you know, consider models which are more, you know, similar to QCD. Then you can think about finite Hoeft coupling corrections. And the reason I put this up is that finite Hoeft coupling really can give rise to richer physics. It can give rise to different timescales, quasi-particles. Now, real-time dynamics with flavor. I think nothing has been done on this. You can think about heavy quark resonances. Do they survive, or do they survive, you know, this plasma phase, or do they disappear? Finite NC corrections to n equal 4. What I mean is that one interesting question is that there are different time scales in which scale this NC. There are times which, you know, order 1, there are times which are order n squared and so on. And, you know, if NC is equal to 3, I mean, it's nice to understand these things. Well, next question is nonlinear hydrodynamics, this hydrodynamic business that I was talking about. And I mean, this talk is purely linearized. So it's not clear how to incorporate nonlinear in ADS-CFT. Gauge field dynamics. Now, in thermal QCD, you can, in perturbative QCD, you can perform, I mean, you can compute propagators, thermal propagators, and extract physical information from these propagators. Now, how does one compute propagators which are gauge-dependent quantities but still contain physical information in ADS-CFT language? And in weakly coupled gauge theories, you can formulate various effective theories which tell you about how these gauge fields evolve. And nothing like that has been done from ADS-CFT point of view. Partonic structure, initial state for the collision. Again, I don't know how useful this can be, but this is, one can definitely think about this. This field theory reason for universality, for eta over s, or any other strong coupling universality which may appear. This would be interesting to understand, but I think it's hard. Now, this issue is more of general relativity issue, which I think it's a project for credits. how to relate the membrane paradigm of Kip Thorne to eddy SFT, which there was this old set of ideas that, you know, black holes have stretched horizon, which behaves as an elastic membrane that has viscosity and conductivity and so on. So there is no good quantitative understanding of that. Now, black hole singularity. Well, the reason I put this up here is that there was a seminar here at KITP, I think, by Hong Liu, who argued that, you know, the black hole singularity can be, you know, investigated by looking at high frequency limits of various thermal two-point functions and seeing if they decay exponentially with a power law with time. Now, again, you know, these two-point functions you can investigate and look at the various power versus exponential dependence, large N scaling, Hooft coupling scaling, and so on. So I don't know, can eddy SFT be useful? I don't know, you tell me. But it would be definitely nice to have more people, you know, working on this area and see if it indeed can be pushed to the extent that it can be actually useful. So.
Thank you.